This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Appearances by the U.S. Attorney General William Barr on Capitol Hill this week could spark fireworks over the 22-month-long investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and its findings. Reuters' Nathan Frandino reports.
Barr starts his appearance before the House Appropriations Committee on Tuesday morning, then takes the witness chair at a Senate panel on Wednesday. While the focus is on the budget, lawmakers could still raise questions on the controversy surrounding Barr's handling of the report. The hearings come 2 weeks after Barr sent Congress a four-page summary of Mueller's main findings, including his conclusion that the Trump campaign had not conspired with Russia in the 2016 race.
Bob will be allowed to finish his work.
Barr has promised to deliver a redacted version of the report by mid-April, but congressional Democrats have been demanding the full unredacted report, which has not been seen by anyone outside of the Justice Department since Mueller delivered it on March 22nd.
That's Reuters' Nathan Frandino reporting. The Secret Service's director is on his way out amid a shakeup at the Homeland Security Department. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
A day after Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen announced her resignation, the White House says Secret Service Chief Tex Alice will be leaving shortly. Three officials say the departures are unrelated, with Alice's move stemming from a personality conflict within the agency. He was a retired Marine general who had no ties to the service when named director 2 years ago, following a review that recommended an outsider take charge. But officials say Alice's unfamiliarity with the Secret Service led to conflicts. The administration says career Secret Service official James Murray will replace Alice next month. Sagar Magani at the White House.
More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. A Maryland man has been arrested for an alleged Islamic State-inspired terror plot to run down pedestrians with a truck. Federal prosecutors plan to ask a judge not to grant bail for 28-year-old Rondell Henry of Germantown, Maryland, during a Tuesday court appearance. They will argue that he is a flight risk and a threat to the community. Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski says that Henry was arrested on March 28th, just outside the nation's capital, as authorities broke up an alleged plot to ram the stolen U-Haul truck into pedestrians at a popular landmark.
It became more than a simple stolen vehicle, and using good forensics in Montgomery County, using good thoughtful interviews in Alexandria and in Prince George's County, we and the agents were able to piece this together and understand that this was not simply a person in a stolen vehicle, but posed a greater threat.
Prosecutors allege that Henry stole the truck from a suburban Washington shopping mall last month and drove around looking for terror targets. After failing to breach security at Dulles International Airport, Henry is accused of driving to the National Harbor in Maryland, a Potomac River walkway lined with shops and restaurants highly popular with tourists. Police arrested Henry the next morning after he climbed out of a docked boat in which he hid all night and jumped over a security fence. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for Monday's attack outside Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed three U.S. service members and one American contractor. The U.S. military medically evacuated three other U.S. service members who were wounded in the attack. They said the three troops are now in stable condition. Libyan authorities have closed the only functioning airport in Tripoli after an airstrike Monday, as a battle for the capital continues between rival forces and the country. Security officers at the airport east of the Libyan capital said that no side had yet claimed responsibility for the attack, which hit the runway but caused no casualties. Forces loyal to military commander General Khalifa Haftar have been continuing a push aimed at taking the capital. The U.S. and Iran are now at odds by an unprecedented move led by the Department of State that puts a very specific designation on part of Iran's government. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
For the first time, the United States is designating a part of another government as a terrorist organization targeting Iran's Revolutionary Guards, which is the Islamic Republic's most powerful security organization. U.S. President Donald Trump, in a statement, calls the IRGC Iran's primary means of directing and implementing its global terrorist campaign. Iran responded by putting U.S. military forces on its list of terror groups. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
And I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. James Buckley, Washington. Today's Tuesday, April 9th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Is Sudan's opposition divided on how to get rid of embattled President Omar al-Bashir?
I believe it's safer in such circumstances to have a negotiated settlement. That's the only way you can avoid bloodshed. This is based on experience.
Ghazi Atabani is the leader of the Reform Now political party in Sudan. Malawi's president is criticized for referring to civil society groups as criminal society organizations. Refugee students in Uganda find hope in secondary vocational skills. And UNICEF says 175 million children globally are not enrolled in pre-primary education.
I think the biggest finding here is that unless we make pre-primary education a public good and equally available for free, the way that the majority of the education in the early years should be available, then it's very likely that these inequities will persist.
Evelina Borisova is the education specialist at UNICEF. An international conference on human trafficking is underway just outside the Italian capital, Rome. And we'll tell you why a new Senegalese TV series is causing waves. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudanese protesters on Monday appealed to the military to help in removing President Omar al-Bashir from power. A soldier was reportedly killed Monday as troops intervened to stop security officers from breaking up a rally. But Sudan's defense minister said Monday that while the military understands the demands of the protesters, it will not allow Sudan to fall into chaos. But how united are the opposition forces calling for the ouster of President Bashir? Ghazi Atabani is the leader of the Reform Now political party in Sudan. He says there is a debate between what he calls the old and experienced politicians and the new revolutionaries about how best to get rid of President Bashir.
I believe it's safer in such circumstances to have a negotiated settlement. That's the only way you can avoid bloodshed. This is based on experience. That's why you find the older elements in opposition in favor of a negotiated settlement, whereas the revolutionary are more inclined towards decisive and maybe even violent action.
Who do you refer to as the revolutionaries? Are you not a revolutionary?
Well, it depends on your definition of revolutionary. If I adopt the more ordinary definition, it's a way of getting things done in a revolutionary way, that's in a perfect way and as quickly as possible. The revolutionaries wish to make or effect this change as soon as possible, and in so doing, sometimes they overlook some of the important details.
So is it fair to say that there is some division within the anti-Bashir movement, where you have some people favoring an overthrow and others wanting negotiation for a transition period?
I wouldn't call it a division, because each group or trend has developed its own way into this present state. So the revolutionaries have emerged from the streets, as it were. Literally, they just appeared in the streets and they started moving things. The other group has grown slowly over the last after independence. So it's not necessarily a division.
The Sudanese defense minister has said that the army understand the complaints of the protesters, but it would not allow itself to be divided. I don't know what he means by that.
I think the army in particular is very keen on its tradition, its heritage as a national army. And they are keen to maintain that image. That's why they have made it very clear to the public in their statement that they were not concerned about the internal strife. And that's why they don't get into confrontation with the ordinary people. I think there's a very strong sense of camaraderie within the army. And that explains why it's detached from the ongoing struggle.
This old and new politicians in this current movement, I'm assuming you are one of the old politicians, as you said. What proposals are you putting before President Bashir that will lead to some kind of a transition?
You know, we've had our independence more than 60 years ago, and we believe it's time to have a decent, workable, functional political system based on democracy and human rights. It's a very simple request, and we are not getting it. That's the problem. The president wishes to stay for another 5 years after he has spent 30 years in office. We are trying to unite our rank and file, unite our political statement vis-a-vis the government, and our immediate priority is to have elections, clean, dry, transparent, and fair elections. And then go on from that point to investing in the future of Sudan being the most well-resourced country in the region.
Ghazi Adabani is the leader of the Reform Now political party in Sudan. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says 175 million children globally are not enrolled in pre-primary education. In its first ever global report on pre-primary education, released today, Tuesday, UNICEF says a family's wealth, mother's education level, and geographical location are among the key determinants for pre-primary attendance. Evelina Borisova, education specialist at UNICEF and one of the report's authors, says if governments today want their workforce to be competitive in tomorrow's economy, they must start investing in early education.
What we mean by that is that in low-income countries, only one in five children has access to preschool education, compared to four in five children in high-income countries. And globally, what this means is that in some instances, more than half of preschool-age children are not enrolled in any kind of early learning programs. What drives this? Well, I believe a lot of governments are starting to put this on their agenda. A lot of donors are beginning pay attention to it, but I believe globally partners haven't necessarily have had a joint voice as to why this matters, not just for young children now, but why it matters for education systems and for societies over the long term. If you don't get this right at the early stages of children's educational journey, it's very unlikely that many of the other interventions will succeed.
You say in the report that the wealth of a household, the mother's education level, and the geographic location are among the key determinants for pre-primary attendance. As you know, the poverty level is high in some countries in Africa. Could you explain this more, please, how this plays in?
Yeah, of course. And thank you for pointing to some of the key findings in the report. And we are, in fact, finding that poverty, mother's education, and residence really make a big difference in terms of the access rates for children. I think you pointed to the two that are the highest, kind of the most impactful ones, and I think we're not surprised that poverty is among them. And I think across the countries with data, we're finding that children living in the poorest households are seven times less likely to attend preschool education compared to their peers who live in wealthier families. And similarly, mothers with secondary education or above, those children with living in such families are more likely to access preschool education, five times more likely than children with mothers who haven't attended primary education. And so I think the biggest finding here is that unless we make pre-primary education a public good and equally available for free, the way that the majority of the education in the early years should be available, then it's very likely that these inequities will persist.
Just, I think it was last year that the new government in Sierra Leone announced that it was giving maybe free public education. What's the role of governments in making this possible?
Oh, it's massive. The prioritization of preschool education begins with the government. The government said the tone that this matters for young children now, but it also matters for the education systems. What we call for in the report is for ministries of education to consider at the minimum 1 year of pre-primary education as a part of their education sector plans and strategies. The Sierra Leone example that you referred to is a very good example where governments have in fact prioritized preschool education as a part of the education sector plan and system. And once prioritized in the sector plan, it is much more likely that governments would actually fund it.
Before I let you go, maybe I want you to address what you said here about the impact of conflict.
Yeah, thank you very much for asking this. Preschool education, while it has tremendous in all contexts, It certainly has even stronger impact on children affected by emergencies and conflict. It not only helps them make sure that there's no break in their development and learning, but it also brings tremendous amount of normalcy and just an opportunity to feel that they can experience play and learning in the way that all children should have the right to do.
Evelina, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
Evelina Borisova is an education specialist at UNICEF. She was speaking with me from New York. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 9th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has come under criticism after referring to civil society groups as criminal society organizations. Speaking to supporters of the ruling party as he campaigned in the capital Lilongwe over the weekend, the president accused civil society groups of working to topple his administration. Nevertheless, the president said he remains determined to implement measures to improve the living condition of Malawians. Gift Trapens is the deputy chairperson of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, a civil society group in Malawi.
I think for us, we are not surprised that we have the president labeling civil society organizations as a criminal society. I think the reason has been that civil society organizations in Malawi have been fighting for accountability, but as well for good governance. So his government has not been accountable enough in terms of the issues of corruption. And that is why his government has had bad relationship with the civil society.
But Gift, this is a situation where civil society organizations have opposed some of the policies that the president espouses. He says that you have been against his government since he was elected into power. Series of demonstrations and protests have been launched against his government. Don't you think him calling you out is right?
I don't think it's right, because the president should be maybe the last person to say that. Why is it that Malawians have been going through the street? Because they have had issues, concerns that his government has failed to resolve. We have had rampant corruption. We have had cases of the killings of people which have been using. We have had cases of even individuals being killed, like the Anti-Corruption Bureau director. So for us, I think what we have been doing is to make sure that this government is able to respond to these issues. But what we have seen is that his government has not responded. We have a government that has the greatest impunity. And that is why maybe the president thinks that we had his government, but we just had his undemocratic tendencies. We don't even have his government. And that is why we have had those demonstrations now and again, because he hasn't responded to any of the issues that we have raised with him.
Well, there have been cases where civil society officials or group members have been openly campaigning or supporting opponents against his government. How do you respond to
that? Yeah, and civil society organizations, actually, it's the other way around. It is his government that has divided the civil society. We have other civil societies that have been funded by his government to fight against fellow civil society leaders. And the civil society that we are talking here, our platform, we don't fight anyone. We just fight on governance issues. We have never sided the opposition. What we do is just to work on the issues.
Gift Trapens is the deputy chairperson of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition in Malawi. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from Lilongwe. The United Nations Refugee Agency estimates that globally, only 1 in 4 refugee adolescents are in secondary school, while the rest, most of them female, are not in school. A Finnish organization is trying to turn the fortunes for young refugees, as Halima Atumani reports from Kawenge in western Uganda.
For refugees like Amina Chimanuka, who fled conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo 4 years ago, survival, not education, is the priority. But as a refugee in Uganda's Rwanja settlement, she was among 500 students who graduated last month from a secondary school run by Finland's largest charity, Finn Church Aid. Chimanuka says she's now prepared to start her own sewing business. Previously, I would just sit home with no work. Luckily, they came and started registering us to go study. I registered, we did entry exams, I passed and went to study for 6 months. Now my life has changed because I can now earn some little money, she says. FinChurch Aid offers the students training in skills ranging from mechanics and welding to hairdressing and sandal making. Vil Vaklin, the manager of the project, says the training is equal to any found in a public school.
Our main goal is to have our diplomas recognized also in the neighboring countries such as DRC and South Sudan, because when the time comes and these refugees are returning home, hopefully to peaceful country, then they can still boost their employability in their new home countries and help to rebuild the societies.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that only half of the children in refugee camps get any education at all. In Romanja, those who don't get admitted into secondary school suffer, says the UNHCR's Chita Kang.
If they are not able to be accepted because of competition, where will they go? They become out of school youth. And sometimes, because of having nothing to do, being redundant in the settlement, they go into alcoholism or to anything that is bad vices.
But for refugees like Chimanuka that do get to study, the education provided by FinChurch Aid is literally life-changing. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kamwenge, Uganda.
An international conference on human trafficking is underway just outside the Italian capital, Rome. Organized by the Migrants and Refugees section of the Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development, the conference focuses on pragmatic ways of implementing the pastoral guidelines on how trafficking. Organizers say the conference seeks to better understand trafficking and help coordinate actions aimed at eradicating it. The conference will also serve to guide the work of the Migrants and Refugees section of the Catholic Church and its collaborators. Father Michael Zernin is Undersecretary for the Migrants and Refugees section at the Vatican.
Well, it's first of all very important for those who are caught up in human trafficking, because it's an opportunity for the Catholic Church and for organizations related with the Church and other partners to redouble their efforts in fighting human trafficking. And that's very important because people who are trafficked really need to be rescued. They need to be liberated. And it's also important because it sheds some light on a very obscure and dark phenomenon in our world, and therefore it needs attention.
What role do you think the Church, the Catholic Church, could play in helping resolving some of these challenges associated with human trafficking?
The Church is already playing an important role, especially in the Catholic sisters who were and are the first ones to reach out and to help and offer help to the victims of human trafficking. So really everywhere in the world you will find Catholic sisters who are involved in the liberation and in the rehabilitation and reintegration of victims of human trafficking. And this is an extraordinary service that they are offering and something that this conference very much supports.
Talk to me about the practicality of the pastoral guidelines on human trafficking and how that could be addressed during this period of the conference.
Well, you are referring to a handbook that our Migrants and Refugees section produced and published at the beginning of this year, which gathers together the experience of Catholic organizations working in this field around the world and distill them into 10 chapters, 10 segments or phases of the work against human trafficking. And this handbook, therefore, is the basis for our discussions during the coming days of the conference.
What would you say would be the expected outcome of this conference?
We hope to deepen our understanding of what human trafficking is and how it works, but especially to share good practices, positive experiences, techniques, approaches, which can be used in different parts of the world where human trafficking is actually taking place and where the victims of trafficking are enslaved.
Father Michael Zerny is the Undersecretary for the Migrants and Refugees section at the Vatican. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotte from Rome. A new Senegalese TV series is causing waves because of its liberating portrayal of women. The series, entitled Mistress of a Married Man, focuses on five complex women in Dakar: a mistress, a married man's wife, a single woman who suffers from PTSD flashbacks due to a sexual assault, another married woman who is a victim of domestic abuse, and her mother-in-law who witnesses the violence. Some conservative groups, such as Jamra, have announced a march to protest the series. Mary Mangier, an associate professor of African and African diaspora literature at Eastern University in North Carolina, she spoke to Ricky Stryak about how the group is challenging a male-dominated society and how that is putting some conservative groups on the defensive.
Senegal has been, having these telefilms for a while now. It's been at least 8-9 years now since they started this series. But then what you would see is a one-dimensional portraiture of Senegalese women. Like, it's very shallow. It's very stereotypical. What probably the patriarchy want women to be. The Senegalese women in real life are not like that. I mean, there are some of them like that, but this is more like a discourse of, like, a caricature of Senegalese women, literally.
Do you think that feeds into stereotypes that men then and other people will have of Senegalese women? And do you think that feeds into real life, you know, that has an impact in real life, actually?
Yes, of course, because telefilms have impact on life, so to say, because if you look at how Senegalese like celebrities, if you have a woman who is submissive and, you know, is a celebrity that everybody is watching, sometimes those people are used as role models, and then women are told, oh, be like this person.
What has been the response? Obviously, the response has been varied. Some people like it, I'm sure. But what has been the critical response?
Well, the critic was actually more focused on the character of Mariam, who's the mistress, especially that line where she said that her sexual parts are hers and she gives it to whoever she pleases. So this was, like, this created some kind of outrage among some, like, maybe I would call them religious pundits. But they're not even leaders, literally. They're people who have access to some kind of channel or have a YouTube channel, or there's some people follow them, and then they start talking about how it is outrageous that a woman talks like that, notwithstanding that this is a character. And the fact that also there is a woman who exists like that in Senegalese culture, where she is single, she is sexually active, and she is having sex with married men. Because that's something that is very present in Senegalese society.
And it's ironic that their problem is not with Cheikh, the character Cheikh, who is cheating on his wife.
Exactly. In Senegal, there is this normalization of the man who cheats, because polygamy is always wielded as a right for men. He has the right to have four wives, hence he has the right to look at any woman that he wants. And it is normal for a man to literally have mistresses as long as whatever he does sexually is something that is not brought to the public. So it is understood that this man is sexually active with other women, and that's his right because he can have up to four wives. But the minute a woman is, and she is single, so religiously, but the problem seems to be with her. This criticism seems to be with her, not with Cheikh, who is lying to his wife, inventing all kinds of schemes to be able to be with Mariam. Nobody is criticizing that, but the problem seems to be with Mariam.
That was Mary McGee, an associate professor of African and African diaspora literature at East Carolina University. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from North Carolina in the United States. And that is it for this Tuesday, April 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, Voice Post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barty wishing you a good day.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Blended sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.
African Beats. Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the Sunny Side of Sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.